We're going to be talking about mechanical ventilation of the severe asthmatic.
Up to 4% of those patients may actually require intensive care unit admissions.
It's a ventilatory disease. It's not an oxygenation disease.
You really need to pay attention to the auto-PEEP in these patients.
When do we want to pull the trigger on intubating?
They come through on fire.
You have to maximize the EAT time.
Those patients are really fraught with peril.
The outcome didn't turn out so well. Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, joined by Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how goes it this month?
It's going great. Beautiful weather in New Orleans. First weekend Jazz Fest just finished off. It's been outstanding.
Great to hear. Is it moufalatas, Peter?
We have moufalatas in every way that you can possibly eat, shrimp and crawfish. Everything from enchiladas to pastas to stuffing them in beignets. It's a food fest as well as music.
Outstanding. For those of you who have never been to Jazz Fest in New Orleans, it's definitely something that you want to put on the calendar in the subsequent year. It's just an amazing, amazing time. Peter, I'm assuming you can attest to that as well. You've probably attended quite a few.
I've attended, I would say, more than 30. It's been just an outstanding event. And it's always the same time. It's always the last weekend in April and the first weekend in May.
Well, I'm waiting for Peter's invitation to Jazz Fest. So
come on down.
It's going great out here. The weather's finally turning and the Warriors are playing pretty well and, yeah, doing pretty well.
Outstanding. And John, how are things north of Baltimore here?
Well, I don't know much about a moufalata, but I can tell you the cheesesteak is a strong play at any time of the year. And going with the Warriors theme, you know, for all of listeners in Boston, need to watch out because the Sixers are definitely looking pretty strong in the playoffs. So we're excited to get that started. The city is buzzing with excitement. Yeah, so a couple good conferences coming up, which maybe we can talk about at the end. But yeah, going great.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention to some education. We have really an outstanding, a great podcast for you this month. We're going to be talking about mechanical ventilation of the severe asthmatic. Looking back through the podcast, it's actually been quite some time since we specifically did a deep dive on ventilating the severe asthmatic. And the reason I brought it up is we've had a few of you email us over the past several weeks talking about some nuances in mechanical ventilation, specifically in patients with obstructive lung disease. And in addition to that, I recently reviewed a medical legal case on a patient who had acute obstructive airway disease, required ventilation or mechanical ventilation, and the outcome didn't turn out so well. So we thought it'd be a great topic to circle back on since it's been a few years and bring us up to speed on the pearls and more so the pitfalls in mechanically ventilating the severe asthmatic. And as luck would have it, a recent article was just published in the Journal of Intensive Care Medicine a few months ago. Lead author Dr. Lauer entitled that same topic, Mechanically Ventilating the Severe Asthmatic. So Peter, let's kick things off for this podcast. Why is it important? Why do we need to talk about this?
You know, this is a great topic, Mike, and one that emergency medicine has really embraced in the past. I know that early on in my career, the great fear was intubating the asthmatic, and I really think that that was misplaced because I think the big challenge is in actual mechanical ventilation of the intubated asthmatic, but we'll get into that. We know that more than 2 million patients seek care in the U.S. in their emergency departments for acute asthma exacerbations. So this is something that we see routinely. Up to 4% of those patients may actually require intensive care unit admissions. And about 33% of those patients actually require intubation and invasive mechanical ventilation. So when we mechanically ventilate the asthmatic, again, this is the part that I spoke to before. This is the piece that really should get us ratcheted up and a bit on edge because those patients are really fraught with peril. These can develop some very serious life-threatening complications to include abject hypotension, dysrhythmias, barotrauma, laryngospasm, aspiration, as well as seizures. And so if we talk about the risk factors for fatality in asthmatics who actually require mechanical ventilation, what does that poster child look like, or what does that standard patient look like? Well, typically it's younger aged patients. These are patients who have poor outpatient compliance with therapy and follow-up and their action plans pretty lousy. They typically have more than 3 emergency department visits in the preceding year. They've had recent hospitalizations. And again, one of the other things to be wary of is prior episodes of mechanical ventilation for their acute asthma exacerbations.
Outstanding way, Peter, to get that started. Let me just go back. You said some very, very important things in terms of mechanically ventilating the asthmatic patient, high risk for hypotension, dysrhythmias, and that barotrauma that we'll get into shortly. And then I think many of us are in tune to asking about prior mechanical ventilation when we see patients and when was their recent hospitalization. But putting some numbers behind recent ED visits, so more than 3 in the preceding year, we've all seen those patients. And instead of the proverbial young and old being at risk for fatal conditions, or the very, very young, it's more of that younger, middle-aged type of patient coming in that is a risk factor for fatal asthma reactions or exacerbations than going on to require mechanical ventilation. John, let me turn to you in terms of when we pull the trigger. So Peter talked about risk factors, really set the tone nicely. When do we want to pull the trigger on intubating and then initiating mechanical ventilation for these patients?
Absolutely, Mike. And I think that when these patients come through the door, often they come through on fire and it can be really stressful. And I think the most important thing right off the bat is understand that you probably only have a limited amount of time to make your assessment. And so obviously you're going to ask some of those critical questions and try not to talk to the patient too much, but certainly your initial evaluation and physical exam and assessment are going to go a long way. So some things that might risk stratify this patient in terms of needing mechanical ventilation are things if you notice patients starting to become cyanotic. And hypoxia is a little bit different in asthma, right? Because, I mean, for the most part, it's a ventilatory disease. It's not an oxygenation disease. But if the patient is so hypercapnic, they're becoming hypoxic, or the work of breathing has gotten so bad that they're becoming hypoxic or cyanotic, that clearly can be a sign of impending failure. Other things can be worsening mental status from the excessive hypercapnia, signs of exhaustion, paradoxical breathing motions, particularly kind of that thoracoabdominal motion that's going back and forth, can certainly be a sign that they've exhausted their respiratory muscles and now move down to the using their abdominal muscles to try and breathe. And looking up the monitor and seeing a patient who's becoming more bradycardic is certainly concerning that you may need to be a little more aggressive in your respiratory management. Now, if you do get a chance to get an IV established and send off a quick venous blood gas or maybe even a quick ABG, some other triggers that might push you towards intubation early would be a PaO2 less than 60, despite supplemental oxygen therapy, a rising CO2 on serial gases, persistent respiratory acidosis, or obviously impending respiratory arrest. These are all things that at least I'm thinking about as I'm spending the first 5 minutes with this patient to make a decision about whether or not he's going to turn the corner with continuous NEBS and a few other adjunctive treatments, or if we need to act now and place the patient on a ventilator.
Outstanding, John. Let me ask you and then Peter and Rob the same question. You mentioned VBG and following PaCO2s. I find that this comes up frequently at the bedside. Are you using VBGs to follow your PCO2 values in terms of the trend, or do you not believe in them and are you routinely getting ABGs?
Well, I think it's one of the first accessible tests in terms of respiratory status. And so it is something I'm sending right off the bat. And it's certainly important to note that the higher the CO2 gets, the less reliable that number is. And sometimes you may be able to check a delta between the end tidal CO2 and the PCO2 to kind of gauge where you're at. But it does have value, especially right up front, as you're trying to get a number of other things accomplished. And I do trend it as part of my practice.
Peter, how about you?
You know, I have used arterial blood gas predominantly, not serially, but an initial. I tend to use it less now in my practice and look more clinically and look at respiratory rate and kind of the depth of those respirations and make maybe a little bit more clinical decisions than relying on that. I've found, again, just speaking to my practice, that the last thing I want to do is agitate an asthmatic with another stick, particularly an arterial stick, serially, just to give them something else to be really pissed off about. I'd prefer that not to happen.
That's a great point. Rob, how about you? Are you using VBGs following the PCO2 in your practice?
You know, I think I'm in the Peter camp with this. I really have tried to actually to avoid getting PCO2 measurements and serial PCO2s. I find that in addition to agitating the patient, they're agitating the house staff and everybody involved. They start following slight trends. Does the PCO2 change from 60 to 63 mean anything? I really base my decisions mostly on the signs that John mentioned, the signs of mental status and signs of exhaustion. Those are the things that I'm primarily looking at. There are cases in which it's obvious that you need to intubate the patient when they're becoming very cyanotic or if they're completely losing consciousness. So I use those clinical signs more so than I use PCO2 levels.
I would agree with that. Those are great points, gentlemen. Well, Rob, I'm going to stick with you. Let's just say our patient is manifesting those signs that of fatigue using paradoxical respiratory effort motions. They're just tiring out and we need to intubate them. Take us through a few pearls in terms of the intubation, perhaps your selection of RSI meds and then sedatives immediately following tube placement.
Yeah, Mike. So the first two pearls are to avoid nasotracheal route of intubation in these patients. You really should not at all be thinking of putting a nasotracheal tube in these patients. These patients have a lot of relative contraindications to nasotracheal intubation. A lot of them will have severe nasal polyposis. And we also know that nasotracheal tubes are fraught with more complications than endotracheal tubes. So the first point is avoid nasotracheal intubation in these patients. The second pearl is to use the largest ET tube possible. Typically, I'll use an 8 in an adult male, a 7.5 an adult woman. And the reason you want to use a large ET tube is to decrease the resistance in the circuit and also to help your colleagues in the ICU later on. The larger tube makes it a little bit easier to wean patients off the ventilator. They have less resistance when they're trying to do those spontaneous ventilation trials. And it also facilitates suctioning of the airway with a larger ET tube. So second point is to use a large ET tube. So when you're intubating these patients, you remember that these patients are at big risk for hypotension during their RSI. Physiologically, they undergo episodes of dynamic hyperinflation. They also have ventricular interdependence. And these two factors can lead to acute rises in pulmonary vascular resistance, high right-sided pressures, which in turn lead to decreased venous return, decreased RV and LV preload, and then, of course, decreased cardiac output. These patients also, as they're breathing rapidly, they can get very dehydrated from their tachypnea and respiratory effort. These patients are, again, at big risk for hypotension during RSI. So whenever I've decided to intubate a patient with asthma or even for COPD for that matter, I begin a bolus of fluid at that point in time. I typically will anticipate my need for that bolus about 5 to 10 minutes beforehand, before the actual intubation. So I'll start with a bolus of IV fluid, and I'll maintain that bolus going through the time of RSI and intubation. I also have a stick of phenylephrine or another vasopressor ready in hand alongside with my RSI meds, and I'll push that phenylephrine if they drop their pressure post-intubation. So in terms of actual RSI meds, I really go with ketamine. I think ketamine gives you everything you want in these patients. As you all know, it's a great bronchodilator. It preserves cardiac output and is probably the least hypotensive-inducing RSI med that we have available. If a patient appears to be, you know, hypertensive, I may instead use propofol. But I use this with caution because it can lower cardiac output and cause some vasodilatation and worsen the hypotension. Etomidate is also an option. I tend to use this less frequently now that I have ketamine more readily available. In terms of your paralytic for RSI, you can use either Sux or a non-depolarizing agent, typically ROCK. They're both shown to be safe in asthma. So I pick dealer's choice in terms of that. After I've intubated these patients, in terms of sedation, the basic message here is to avoid benzodiazepines. You really do not want to give these patients Versed or Ativan or anything like that. They're not great sedatives in this scenario. So what I typically start with is fentanyl or dexmedetomidine. One of those two are the typical sedatives that I use. If the patient remains hypertensive or has not had any hypotension, propofol is a great option as well. And use of these meds, dex, propofol, or fentanyl, these are associated with shorter ICU length of stay, shorter duration of mechanical ventilation, and improved outcome as compared to benzodiazepines.
Outstanding pearls, Rob. Let me ask Peter and then John, anything else to add to what Rob just said? Any differences in the selection of medications either for RSI, paralytics, or post-intubation sedation?
So I love what Rob says, and that really my practice is very, very similar to his. I would just caution our listeners that to use the sedation liberally, and I use ketamine for my sedation as well, not just for my induction, but also as a sedative. And I use that with fentanyl to try and bring the patients down, because as we see with the settings, you need the patient to be able to cooperate. One of the things that I try to avoid, if I can, is long-term paralytics. The combination of high-dose steroids, which we use to treat the anti-inflammatory component of their asthma, and long-acting paralytics is a setup for the polyneuropathy of critical illness. And so that can be a complication that we would like to avoid.
That's not something we had talked about, but that critical illness polyneuropathy or polymyoneuropathy can certainly be significant for these folks. John, anything else to add?
Yeah, one or two things. So one of the things, and this is coming from maybe one of the younger guys, but certainly use of ultrasound here definitely guides my practice a little bit. So thinking about in terms of whether or not this patient would benefit from any volume, or why might they get hypotensive with RSI. You know, Rob brought up some great points about increased right-sided pressures and the fact that they're basically have a severe respiratory acidosis, high pulmonary vascular resistance, or a setup for RV or transient RV dysfunction and failure. So really careful about how much volume I'm giving or if the patient even needs it. Oftentimes, I might just stick with a vasopressor without any volume at all if it looks like that RV is a little bit more dilated out. Once you introduce positive pressure, ventilation to the mix might tip them over the edge. So early bedside use of focused ultrasound echocardiography can definitely go a long way in terms of giving you an idea of what the lie of the land is as you're approaching a very high-risk intervention such as intubation.
Great, great pearl, John. Peter, let me turn back to you. Let's move through. We've gotten this person intubated, and we've gotten a little bit of post-intubation sedation on board. Now we're looking to set the ventilator. Probably the, as you indicated, to start us off, this is the really, the hard work begins now, really, really challenging. Which mode do you pick? Is it a volume cycled mode or a volume control mode, or on the other hand, pressure control? What's your go-to mode?
Yeah, so I'll get over that and get into that in very clear specifics as to what I typically do. But I just want to make sure that everybody's on board, because when we intubate these patients, their initial peak inspiratory pressures wind up being very high. So the needle swings wildly elevated. Just a reminder to our listeners that that peak inspiratory pressure does not correlate with the risk of lung injury. That's not what the small airways are seeing, but what we're more focused on is the plateau pressure. And that's what we need to be concerned about. Again, peak inspiratory pressures can be in far in excess of 80 centimeters of water pressure. That's the standard. That's not unusual. Plateau pressures are really where we want our focus to be. And then in the asthmatic, plateau pressures are typically normal. The pathophysiology that we see in asthma is airway closure and edema of the small distal airways, not really within the alveolus itself. As long as the plateau pressures maintain less than 30, high levels of peak inspiratory pressures are not associated with the risk of either barotrauma, volutrauma, or alveolar injury, just so that we understand that. An increase, though, in the plateau pressure could really suggest either an expanding pneumothorax, worsening bronchospasm, or actually gas trapping. And so I would just be wary of that. When we start talking about which mode do I go to, again, people compare and contrast really volume control versus pressure control. In my practice, I'm a volume control guy, particularly for the asthmatics. I find that there's less dynamic hyperinflation, less auto-cycling of the ventilator with the volume-controlled modes compared to the pressure-controlled modes. There really is no overall outcome differences between volume-controlled or pressure-controlled, so that our listeners are aware of that. Again, volume-controlled mode is generally preferred, and this is because we can clearly follow peak inspiratory pressures and plateau pressures. The pearl here is to be sure to reset the upper pressure limit to a value above the patient's intrinsic peak inspiratory pressure. And this prevents potentially fatal alveolar hypoventilation. And so that's an important understanding if we're going with pressure cycle.
Outstanding, Peter. Well, Rob, let me turn to you and take us through the rest of the settings.
Yeah, so in terms of the rest of the settings, the key principle here is that you have to maximize the EAT time. You have to maximize that expiratory time. So you need to set the ventilator up such that you're allowing the inflated air to expire, to blow out, and to avoid the buildup of intrinsic PEEP or auto PEEP. So I also use a volume cycled mode in general. And so the prime way to maximize your EAT time is to set a low respiratory rate. So we're talking about respiratory rates in the 6 to 10 breaths per minute range, really pretty far below typically half of what we typically set the ventilator rate at. So 6 to 10 breaths per minute, more or less, a low tidal volume as well. Again, we're talking about 4 to 6 cc's per kilo, more or less, in terms of the tidal volume. So you're getting into the 300 to maybe at most 400, let's say, tidal volume for patients. And then in terms of FiO2, you need to adjust the FiO2. Not typically too worried about hypoxia at this point. So you just need to adjust the FiO2 to maintain the SAT above more or less 94%. You don't want to oversaturate them. You don't want to keep them on 100% FiO2, which we've talked about in the past can be associated with some complications, some poor outcomes. So you really just need to dial that FiO2 to keep it about 94% or higher, the O2 sat. The other things to think about, you need to monitor, as Peter mentioned, the main pressure that you're monitoring here. There are really two pressures that you're monitoring here. There's the plateau pressure, in which you're trying to keep it below 30 centimeters of water, and the auto PEEP. You really need to pay attention to the auto PEEP in these patients. And that's the biggest pearl that I would say in terms of these pressures. We've all seen cases in which you've had auto PEEP induced cardiac arrest, really, auto PEEP induced hypotension and cardiac arrest. And so you need to frequently monitor that auto PEEP. In terms of the peak inspiratory pressure, as Peter mentioned, that's not something that we worry about too much. That's not reflected in the pressure at the alveoli, at the lower airways. So you need to adjust the alarm, as Peter mentioned, to allow for patients to have a higher peak inspiratory pressure. And finally, in terms of your PEEP, for these patients, I typically give them either zero PEEP or perhaps at times low levels of PEEP, maybe 3 to 5 at most. There's some evidence that if you give them a little bit of PEEP on the ventilator, that you can at times decrease their auto PEEP and decrease their work of breathing. So there are times when I'll give just a little bit on the order of 3 to 5, more or less. And then finally, in terms of your inspiratory flow rates and IDE ratios, which are tied together. The inspiratory flow rates, you're really going to want to be using high inspiratory flow rates. We're talking about 80 to 100 liters per minute on the higher side. Sometimes I even go up to 120 on these patients. And what you're trying to do is by giving a high inspiratory flow rate, you're minimizing the I time and you're maximizing the E time. Alternatively, on the ventilator, you set your IDE ratio on the 1-4 or 1-5 scale.
Rob, that was outstanding. I think you've covered virtually every knob on the ventilator and really provided us with some insight in terms of this challenging patient population. Let me ask John and then Peter, any things that you would tweak with that or all in line with the things that Rob?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts for everyone to be aware of. I think that one of the classic mistakes that people get into with these types of patients, and Rob's touched on this and emphasized it nicely about the respiratory rate, is they come in breathing with a respiratory rate of 24 to 28. And I think just by recency bias, we think of that patient who's compensating for a metabolic acidosis and they're like, oh, I got to keep the respiratory rate the same. And clearly that's not the disease we're talking about. We're talking about obstructive airway disease. And so for me, I personally shoot for a little bit of a higher tidal volume. So I'm not as worried about lung injury in terms of like you are with ARDS patients. So I generally try to target tidal volume a little bit higher, so 6 to 8 cc's per kilo. And my respiratory rate might be a little bit higher too. I think in general, I try to keep my minute ventilation somewhere between 10 and 14 liters a minute. And there's a reason for that. So obviously everyone has their amount of dead space that you want to avoid just doing dead space ventilation. So if everyone's dead space is around 150, 180 mLs, when you get into that 4 mL per kilo range, you start getting into really low minute ventilation, which can, you end up just dead space ventilating and not really getting any air to the alveoli. So just to summarize, I tend to err on the side of a minute ventilation around 10 to 14 liters a minute, and you can accomplish that, but with a little bit of a higher tidal volume. And then certainly all the same things that Rob said.
Peter, anything to add?
Just that the biggest impact on the IDE ratio is the respiratory rate. That's the biggest bang for the buck. Second biggest bang for the buck is the tidal volume. And then the third biggest bang for the buck is the peak flow, how fast we deliver that tidal volume breath. So in short, we want infrequent, small tidal volume breaths being delivered rapidly. And that affects your IDE ratio and allows more time for exhalation, because the trouble with the asthmatic is less getting oxygen in and the tidal volume in and more with getting trapped air out. And so as we're supporting the patient and treating them with their steroids and their bronchodilators and magnesium, the hope is to empty out that trapped volume.
Well, Peter, that was an excellent segue into our final few questions here. We're going to go through these fairly quickly. But John, Peter just mentioned trapped gas. How can we detect that this is occurring in our patient?
So this is a great question, Mike. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different terms that people might hear getting kicked around about, you know, with this concept of gas trapping. People may have heard it described as auto PEEP, intrinsic PEEP, dynamic hyperinflation, but they all essentially mean the same thing. It means that air is being pushed into the patient and there's not enough time for all of that volume to get out. And so I'll do the best I can to describe this in a auditory, basically these visualized things in an auditory podcast. But if everyone kind of thinks about when they look at a ventilator, there's three separate curves, waveforms that you can see on the ventilator. There's basically a pressure waveform, usually at the top of the screen, a flow waveform in the middle, and then a volume waveform at the bottom. And these are all measured over time. So I think the easiest way to detect if there's actual auto PEEP or excessive amounts of volume left in the patient's lungs after a respiratory cycle, you can do this really simply. All you have to do is basically press the end expiratory hold button. And if you're not sure where this is, you can always ask your respiratory therapist. And some of the best times to do this are really right after RSI, when the patient's still paralyzed within the first couple of minutes and you've gotten a minute or two of positive pressure breaths going in to see if the patient has a high amount of auto PEEP. And so what happens is when you press that end expiratory hold is that during the expiratory phase of the patient's breath cycle, it'll pause and the vent will actually measure the amount of pressure that's left within the patient's lungs at the end of expiration. And if you compare this to the amount of PEEP that you've set, if it's higher than that, well, then you subtract the two and that's the amount of auto PEEP you have. Now, some auto PEEP is okay, obviously not ideal, but excessive amounts, you know, once you start getting into that auto PEEP range of like 20, 25, that's really concerning. It means you need to address your ventilator or fix it in some way or fix your patient. Now, you can also look at this visually without maybe doing a measurement by looking at the flow waveform. So the easiest way to do this would be if you take a look on the patient's expiratory limb, so the part on the bottom below the baseline, if it doesn't return all the way back to baseline before another positive pressure breath is triggered, then that's indicative that the patient may be auto-PEEPing or the flow out isn't all the way back to baseline prior to taking another positive pressure breath. And subsequently, every single breath, the patient will have retained volumes leading to auto-PEEP. And the last waveform, the one on the bottom, is that volume waveform, and it usually looks like a triangle. And in the asthmatics, you're going to see a breath in and then a very slow slope or gradual slope back to baseline as the patient breathes out. And if this curve doesn't get back to zero, back to baseline, that can be indicative of auto-PEEP as well. I think some of us may be more familiar with seeing this curve not getting back to baseline if someone has a cuff leak or something like that, or has an air leak because they have a chest wall trauma and there's basically an air leak in their chest tube. Some of the volume isn't getting back to the ventilator is all that means. So if you see that, be concerned that maybe there's some auto-PEEP.
That was super helpful, John. In terms of, I think I would agree with you with the flow time waveform, just looking at that, making sure that the expiratory flow does return back to the baseline, and that can really give you a lot of information without having to have a whole lot of technical background. You're able to look at those three waveforms and make some really, really informed decisions. Well, Peter, let's just say we've done that, and we're trying to be thoughtful about it, but all we can hear in the background is that ding, ding, ding of the ventilator, the high-pressure alarms going off. What do we do other than simply just push the silence button? Help us through this.
Yeah. So the last thing we want to do is just push the silent button and just say, more sedation, right? And there's a tendency to want to do that, but we really need to be critical of our thought process and how we approach this. And again, what we want to do is pay attention to the pressure time waveform. And again, if our listeners are not savvy with this, it's not poor form to pull your respiratory therapist to the bedside and go over this with them. Because we really want to see if these high pressures are due to an increase in resistance or an increase in compliance. So worsening compliance, and by this we mean increase in the peak inspiratory pressure and the plateau pressure with no change in the gradient between the two. Again, when we do that, we want to consider dynamic hyperinflation or the auto-PEEP or intrinsic PEEP that you heard John speak to us about. You also want to consider in your differential pneumothorax, as well as now new pneumonia or aspiration of contents or mucus plug, rapidly developing ARDS, atelectasis, as we mentioned, and again, that's going to be associated with mucus plugging or bronchial concretions. We want to quickly either get a chest x-ray or bedside ultrasound to, again, to eliminate some of the things such as pneumothorax very quickly, and also look at the other dynamics within the lung to look at B lines and other things that may indicate a pneumonia. But when indicated, and again, if it's not just alarms, but now you're talking about an unstable patient, one of the first and most important things you can do is to completely disconnect the patient from mechanical ventilation. This is critically important. And one of the things that I do when patient is hypotensive or profoundly tachycardic and the vent is alarming is disconnect the patient and place two or three sets of hands on the patient's thorax and compress, squeeze. And again, what this is designed to do is to get rid of trapped volume. So if there has been dynamic hyperinflation, this helps get rid of some of that trapped volume and trapped pressure. In fact, I do this technique as soon as I've intubated my asthmatics. Before I even bag them, I will have people squeeze, and you will hear a very distinctive noise coming out, and it's not a pleasant whoosh, but it's more along the lines of a squeaking through this tight air through, you know, constricted small airways. But I do that. The other things that I do is try and troubleshoot and see where the tube is, try and visualize what that is with direct laryngoscopy versus indirect, so I can visualize where the tube is, look for things like dislodgement, and then the first few breaths with the bag, I deliver. I don't give that to somebody else, because that tactile information for just the first two breaths helps me troubleshoot. Because if I squeeze the bag and it's incredibly tight, then I'm thinking obstruction. If I squeeze the bag and the air is very easy to go in and suddenly their cheeks are pushing out or flapping in the breeze, I'm thinking there's been complete dislodgement. And again, those first two squeezes with the bag give me lots of information. I make sure that I have bronchodilator therapy ongoing. If I'm worried about pneumonia, I'm thinking about antibiotics, adding those. If it's pneumothorax and the patient is decompensating, I'm thinking either needling the patient followed quickly by a chest tube. And then again, obstruction or concretions, I may think about bronchoscopy.
Well, in terms of the compliance, Peter, that was super helpful in terms of walking through what to think about when we have that increase in the peak inspiratory pressure along with an increase in plateau. What happens if you have an increase in peak inspiratory pressure? We've talked about it not being as predictive, but when we check the plateau pressure, it's kind of the same. What's that indicating?
The thought process here, if in fact the PIP is escalated up and the plateau pressure remains low, we want to really make sure that we are considering mechanical ventilator as a problem. And that may be auto cycling on its own. There may be some other issues. And it's critical at that time to make sure that we're disconnecting the patient from that mechanical ventilator.
Outstanding pearls. Thanks so much, Peter. In terms of that alarm, the tendency, I'm sure we've all had it and we've all seen it, that alarm is going off and we see someone come in and just push that silence button for 2 minutes and hope that it doesn't recur. So you've given us a lot of good pearls in terms of walking through what to think about really when that alarm is going off. Well, Rob, I'm going to hit the last question for you in terms of this podcast. We talked a little bit about CO2 values to kind of get us started a little while ago. We really didn't touch on the concept of permissive hypercapnia. So we're allowing some of the CO2 levels to rise because we really want to be cognizant of allowing adequate time for exhalation. And that in and of itself will tend to elevate the CO2 values, produce hypercarbia. What is this concept of permissive hypercapnia? And really, how low or how high do you tolerate the CO2 level and how low do you tolerate the pH?
Yeah, so again, Mike, we talked about how the status asthmatica state is a state in which they have significant retention of CO2 from their expiratory obstruction and their gas trapping. These patients really routinely become hypercarbic. And the basic principle here is you have to resist the urge to overreact, to overtreat that hypercapnia, and understand that you can accept a certain level of hypercapnia and acidosis. I remember a case report, a phenomenal case report of a case in which a patient was undergoing a procedure, I believe it was a cosmetic surgery procedure, and the patient was undergoing MAC ventilation with just a mask and a bag valve mask, and they finished the procedure in like 30 minutes. And then they tried to wake the patient up, and the patient didn't wake up. And, you know, the patient hadn't really received too much sedation. And so they decided to check an ABG in this patient. This was a case report, again, from about 20 years ago or more. And on that ABG, they found that the patient's pH was 6.6, and they had a PCO2 of 280. So obviously the patient was narcotized, had severe hypercapnia and acidosis. So what did they do? They just intubated the patient. They blew the patient down and blew that hypercapnia down, and the patient woke up. The patient never had any hemodynamic compromise, didn't have any problems when he woke up after the procedure later on. And so this is a testament to the fact that hypercapnia and acidosis of itself aren't that big a deal in the asthmatic patient, and that you can accept a level of hypercapnia and acidosis. And the numbers that we're talking about here are, in general, it's mainly directed at the pH. And you certainly will accept the pH as low as 7.25, even 7.2. even occasionally below 7.2 with corresponding CO2s in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. You can accept that as long as the patient is oxygenating well and the patient is hemodynamically stable. So the principle here is, and this is what we were talking about, the prime goal or the prime mode of ventilation or principle behind these modes of ventilation is that you can accept a higher PCO2 and a lower pH in these patients, and you want to avoid hyperventilating these patients and avoid trying to correct that hypercapnia of itself. Additionally, you should also try and avoid bicarb in these patients, because what does bicarb get converted to? Basically, it gets converted to CO2, and so you're not going to necessarily fix the problem by giving these patients bicarb. So this principle of permissive hypercapnia, accepting higher PCO2s and lower pH, is the guiding principle, really, behind all of what we talked about in terms of those vent settings, of those lower respiratory rate and lower tidal volume vent settings.
Outstanding, Rob. That was a great way to wrap up what has been a super helpful discussion. I want to thank all three of you for the pearls and thoughts on this very sick patient, along with one of this more riskier things in terms of patient outcome, the potential for harm when we go, as Peter stated to start us off, when we go to mechanically ventilate the asthmatic patient. I know it's been talked about over the past many, many years, but still to this day, we're seeing a lot of increased morbidity and even mortality when we go to ventilate the asthmatic patient. Any final thoughts, gentlemen, Peter, Rob, and then John, as we bring this discussion to a close?
You know, just a reminder again to our listeners, as soon as I've placed an endotracheal tube in these patients, or if I'm disconnecting them from mechanical ventilation, I really am putting 2 and 3 sets of hands on the thorax just to compress. And this takes literally seconds to do this. I've had great success with that, in particular those patients who wind up being hypotensive. So just a thought for our listeners.
Great pearl, Peter. Rob, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I want to second that motion or that idea that Peter brought up. And this is something that disconnecting the patient from the ventilator after they've been intubated for asthma and the alarms are going off and they develop hypotension, remember that the first maneuver, again, is to disconnect them from the ventilator and let them blow that out. This is on all of our board exams, on our recertification exams. It's a basic principle that you have to understand, and it really does show up. I mean, it's one of those things that has been taught in books, but we actually see in practice quite a bit. So don't forget, just always remember the first maneuver. If the patient drops their pressure, you're having trouble hearing breath sounds bilaterally, is to disconnect them from the ventilator.
Well said. And John, final word.
The only thing I'd add is more adjunctive therapies, and we didn't dive too much into this, but certainly early consideration if your patient isn't tolerating your ventilator for extracorporeal support, if you have it available to you, call your anesthetist, your CT surgeon. Usually this can be established pretty quickly, and the runs are really, really short, usually in the matters of 2 to 3 days at most. So definitely keep it in your back pocket. Certainly if you have it readily available to you or at a nearby institution you can refer the patient to.
All right, and that's going to do it for this podcast. Many thanks to all of you who have written with the new format to CCPEM. Some great feedback, continuing to make updates and modifications to our new platform. If you have any questions regarding this discussion on mechanical ventilation of the severe asthmatic patient, please, please let us know. We love corresponding and have gotten great, great questions over the past several months as we've stepped into 2018. We're going to go ahead and end things here as we know we're a little bit long, and we'll look forward to talking with you next podcast. Bye for now.